Bob Banks, a member of SABR, and I'm here talking with Clyde Stukeforth at his home in Waldoboro, Maine on December 6, 1994. Clyde, you had a long career in professional baseball, starting in 1925 and going until 1975. Could you tell us about the start, the scout that talked with you and signed you, and the circumstances around that when you first signed a professional baseball contract?
Well, it so happened that I was playing semi-pro ball in that New England Industrial League. I was with the Nashua Club. And Tommy Whalen was our manager. And Tommy Whalen, evidently, thought I had possibilities, and he really signed me. I mean, I don't know that he drew up the contract, but he was the one that recommended me, and I never did meet the fellow that actually drew up the contract, and that's not important anyway. Nowadays, the scouts, it's a consensus of opinion. I mean, you have an area, and 15 other scouts have areas. They send in their reports, and then they have cross-checkers, they call them. They'll go from one club to another. And we say, you have two or three players you like. Well, the fellow in the next scouting area, he'll have some. Well, they have cross-checkers that go around and compare them.
Now then you played a little bit in the minors, and then you were with Cincinnati and Brooklyn for 10 years in the majors. And I guess you also came back in 1945 and played a year during World War II there, where there was a shortage of players.
I caught a few games in 45. The catchers were all in the service. There was a shortage. Had to be.
Your peak year was 1929 when you hit 354. Did everything seem to be going right for you that year?
Oh yes, a fellow with my ability, I guess, would have to get a lot of breaks to hit 350. But I had never played regular before. I get to bat once a week. I'd run for Bubbles Hargrave, and maybe next week I'd run for him again. And that's the way the thing had been going. But after I broke in, then I got traded over to Brooklyn.
How'd you get your break so that you weren't just running for Bubbles Hargrave to get more catching duty in?
Well, Bob couldn't catch. He couldn't catch every game I'm in. He had led the league in hitting, and he's gonna do practically all the catching. And somebody has to relieve him. And that somebody was me for a couple of years.
And then Johnny Gooch was a catcher?
Then they picked up Johnny Gooch. And I think Johnny, being a switch hitter, he probably would have kept me out of the lineup pretty much. But he had the misfortune of having a death in his family, and they had to use me, and I got a few hits, and
then you stayed on as a regular there for a while.
A couple of years I did most of catching.
Then after your playing days in 34, you spent your time then for as a manager in the minor leagues?
What was that?
I say after your playing days ended with the Dodgers in 1934, you managed down in the minor leagues for a while?
Yeah, I was in Carolina, Leakesville, North Carolina, and 36, Clinton, Iowa, in the 3I League, and 37, Elmira, New York, and 38 and 39. And then I had the Montreal club in 40, 41, and 42. And 43 was when Mr. Rickey came into Brooklyn.
So he had you come to come up with the Dodgers at that time in 43?
Well, he signed me as a coach. But he sent me out on some scouting assignments, and he must have been satisfied because he sent me quite often. It's easier to, I'm with the club. He knows where I am. If he wants a scout quick, he can get me in 5 minutes. Well, those scouts, they have itineraries, and they subject to change, and you don't know the hotels they're staying at the different places. Like I say, I was a convenience scout.
Now, as time has gone along and history has been made, one of your assignments that Mr. Rickey gave you to scout has gained extreme significance in the history of baseball. Tell us about the Jackie Robinson assignment.
Well, in 44 and 45, we were all taking a look at the Negro National League. And I happened to be in New York and headquarters there, and every Sunday there'd be a doubleheader. If the Yankees were on the road, it would be at Yankee Stadium. Otherwise, doubleheader at the Polo Grounds. And then there was the Newark club, the Philadelphia club, and those were the clubs that I saw mostly. And he called me in one day and he said, the Kansas City Monarchs are playing the Lincoln Giants in Chicago on Friday night. He said, I want you to see that game, paying particular attention to a shortstop named Robinson, especially his arm. He said, I want you to identify yourself. Tell him who sent you and what you want to see. He said, if you like his arm, bring him in. If his schedule will permit. Otherwise, make an appointment for me and I will come out there. Well, I'm the smartest guy in the world, but I know he's ready to do something. He's a busy man if he's going to drop everything and go see a free agent ball player. Well, we were allowed to to think that I say aloud that there was a club in Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Brown Bombers. We could have been scouting for them, but I don't know what the other fellows did, but most of us made ourselves as inconspicuous as possible around in the college ballparks and at the college games. That's why he told me, introduce yourself and tell them who sent you. Oh, he knew an awful lot about that ball. He'd had all kinds of reports from the college newspaper men, Wendell Smith, Oscar Charleston was a big help. See, if we want to get some information on a college ball player, it's quite an undertaking. I mean, you go in there and the first thing, you know, everybody's curious to know why, what's he doing in here? Well, if we saw a young boy that might have possibilities, Oscar Charleston had all that information. That is, the important things, the boy's habits, his age, those things are hard to come by. You can't see that from the stands. And Oscar was a big help. And newspaper men, Wendell Smith. Wendell was a pitcher in the league, and then became a newspaper man, a sports writer with the Pittsburgh Courier, I believe it was. It's a college publication in Pittsburgh. Well, I get to Chicago, and I go out to Commissioner Clark, and I get there early. Concession stands aren't even open. I can't get a scorecard, but I pick up an old one that's laying around there, and I see on that it may be correct and it may not. It's late in the season, but it had Robinson number 8. So I'm down in the front row, and when these players came out, Robinson came out with a couple other boys, and I called them by name. And I could see the scorecard was right. Well, he came over and just did my errand, told him. That's what Ricky told me to tell him. And naturally, he was amazed. He can't understand why Ricky is interested in him. And he keeps coming right back to that. And I tell him, I say, Jack, I just work here. But I do know there's a lot of interest in you. That's all I can tell you. That's all I know. Well, he said, I fell on my shoulder the night before last, and I'm not going to be able to play at all for several days. So that worked out just right. I was supposed to see a doubleheader in Toledo on Sunday. This was Friday night. Saturday's no good, Sunday's no good, we're not losing any time there. So I said, how about meeting me down at the hotel after the game? I probably won't see more than 6-7 minutes. Funeral player. And he did. I had a long talk to him. I asked all the questions that I thought Mr. Ricky would be asking him. His experiences in the Army, you know, racial problems, he had an injury too. No football injury. But it apparently wasn't bothering him. Well, anyway, I said, if you can meet me in Toledo on Sunday, and we checked the railroad schedules, and there's a train going from Chicago to Toledo that would get him in there just about the middle of the doubleheader. Everything was on schedule. So he said, sure, be glad to. Well, I had made reservations and he came in right on time. We had dinner, got into Pullman, arrived in New York the next morning, and he's familiar with New York, he'd been around. I said, you are going to meet me over, do you want me to pick you up, or you familiar with transportation over here? Oh, he said, yeah, I can get around. He said, I'll meet you. I told him, 2:15 Monte Cristo, 9 o'clock, he was there. You know the rest. I introduced him to Mr. Ricky. I said, this is Jack Robinson. But I haven't seen his arm. I know he didn't hear me because he's studying him. I mean, he looked right through those young fellows. Really sizing them up. But he proceeds from there, and on the strength of the fact that I haven't seen him, I didn't worry too much about it. Supposing his arm isn't 100% for a shortstop, with other places he could play. And it developed that he did. He broke in at first base. He could play anywhere. He had that kind of versatility. And but at the same time, I was a little bit concerned because I hadn't seen his arm. Never did see him play till we get to Sanford, Florida the next spring.
Now, that was quite a long conversation with Ricky and you and Robinson. Mr. Ricky really laid out his expectations to Robinson and
I guess he did. He said, all my life I've been looking for a great college ball player. He said, I have some reason to believe that you might be that man. But he said, I have to have more than a great ball player. He said, I have to have a man who will accept the worst imaginable insults and the most abuse that a man can be subjected to and turn the other cheek. And he said, now if some guy slides into you and calls you a black so-and-so, you'd be justified to come up swinging. They said, you set the cause back 20 years. Robinson gave that a lot of thought. He was talking Montreal contract to him now of the preparation year in the International League. He said, I think I can play in the International League, and I think I can play in Brooklyn. But I'll accept your opinion on that But he said, he gave this quite a lot of thought before he said it. And I know that impressed him, impressed Ricky. Some eager beaver might say, oh, sure, right off quick, without realizing the seriousness of what he is saying. So he said, I think I can play in Montreal, and I think I can play in Brooklyn, but I'll accept your judgment on that. But if you want to take this gamble, I'll promise you there'll be no incident. He had talked to him. You can't even answer back for 3 years. And he did. He took to the abuse in 46. And again in 47. Cancel a game in Jacksonville. We were only in spring training in Sanford. We had Robinson and Johnny Wright. Pitcher, also a black boy, and goes along, I would say, I don't know exactly how long, but it was not more than a week. I bumped into Mr. Ricky on the way up, out to the clubhouse, and he said, well, we got the word last night. I said, what was that? Get the two black boys out of town before midnight, or we will. So they moved them over to Daytona Beach. The Montreal club was just reporting at Daytona Beach, so just moved them on over there. But they had a game scheduled up in Jacksonville. I think it was the first, one of the early, yeah, it was the first exhibition game. And the Jacksonville club called up and said to Mr. Ricky, don't bring that nigger up here. There won't be any games, you do. Mr. Ricky said, you're talking to the wrong man. It so happens that Mr. Hopper is the manager of this club, and he picks the players. Well, if he picks that black man, there'll be no game, but the bus goes up, and sure enough, the gates are locked. DeLand, Florida. We're not going to be able to make our scheduled game. We're having a light problem. Well, that hurt Robinson. I mean, figures it's not only depriving him of an opportunity to better himself, but he is handicapping the other boys. I mean, these games being canceled. That really hurt him.
Well, the bench jockeying must have been pretty rough, too.
What's that?
The bench jockeying must have been pretty rough when he started.
You have no idea. You have no idea. You couldn't imagine it. Philadelphia. And you know the ironic part of the whole thing. In a couple of years, we can't get an a good exhibition game in the spring without guaranteeing those in that same atmosphere, the southern atmosphere. We can't get a spring training exhibition game without guaranteeing the appearance of Robinson and Campanella. Well, it just shows you, we were talking about the reason for the strike. I think that same thing enters into it. He can fill your ballpark. He don't look quite so dark.
Well, as it proved out, Mr. Ricky certainly made the right choice of the person to pave the way. It's hard to believe that anybody else could have done what Jackie Robinson did, or taken the strain and pressure and the abuse that he did and carried through.
There's some outstanding ball players in that league then, but for one reason or another, they didn't meet all the requirements. Josh Gibson, a great catcher, maybe one of the greatest that ever lived, probably. Could do it all with tremendous power. Satchel Paige, too old. Lots of them. Good ball players.
So before this meeting with you and Robinson and Ricky, Ricky had compiled a lot of information on a lot of Negro athletes, ball players. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. The sports writer of Baltimore was a good baseball man, Sam Lacy. He had furnished reports, and Wendell Smith. Wendell Smith just called me a couple times when he couldn't locate Mr. Ricky.
Now, your scouting efforts with the Dodgers at that time was on a interim or intermediate type of basis, and you were primarily coaching and traveling with the team. Is that right? And then a scouting assignment might. Did in those days did they have advanced team scouting? Did they send scouts ahead to look at teams you were going to play?
It just started about that time.
Did you do any of that?
No. There were more experienced scouts, I imagine.
Then after 51, Mr. Ricky went to Pittsburgh, and you followed him there from the both of you went to the Pittsburgh from the Dodgers.
That's right.
And then your function there with Mr. Ricky, tell us about that, your days there with him in Pittsburgh.
That's the same deal, pretty much.
Coaching and scouting.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any scouting experiences there in Pittsburgh that you remember well, as far as athletes, that prospects that turned out to be pretty good ball players in their day?
Well, he called me one day and he said, the Brooklyn Club has sent Joe Black to Montreal. And the Montreal Club is opening a 5-game series in Richmond tonight. It's in the morning. He called me. And he said, go on down there and stay until you see Joe Black pitch. He's really high on Joe Black. Well, I got down there and just in time the Montreal Club was taking their infield practice. And they had a baby-faced Negro out in right field with a great arm. Young-looking boy. Well, the game starts and he's not playing. Well, along about, I think it was around the seventh inning, he sent up as a pinch hitter there behind, and he hit a routine ground ball to the shortstop, and it was a bang-bang play at first base. He can really run. Two things that are most important. So naturally, I'm out there for 5 nights. I'm watching him in batting practice. And Joe Black never did pitch. And I asked Macon, I knew Macon well. I had dinner with him every night. He played for me in Montreal. And I asked him, now when are you going to pitch this guy? And he said, well, he said, he's on rehab. He said, depends on how he feels. As soon as he feels he wants to pitch, right, he said, he's in there. But that's indefinite. So I send in a report on Clemente. And you know, they drafted him for $4,000. The Brooklyn club had so many good-looking ball players. You can only control 40. They had so many that if they had problems. They had some good-looking kids. Well, they missed one there.
And your report was pretty good on Clemente, I bet.
Oh. Your Aunt Kate could could recognize that kind of talent.
Then from Pittsburgh, you went with Atlanta, and that was really, was that your first full-time scouting when you went with Atlanta?
Yeah. But that's way back in, that's much later, that's 1966 was the first year I was with the
Glen. Uh-huh. And you you had territory then that you covered with them?
New England, yes.
Uh-huh. And who were some of the prospects that you scouted there that became major league ball players with Atlanta?
Oh, there was Almon, shortstop with college coach. Can't think of it offhand.
Bill Almon?
Yeah.
With Brown, wasn't he with Brown?
Hmm?
Wasn't he at Brown?
Brown, yeah.
Yeah.
And, oh, there were a lot of, players. Big catcher with Harvard. Great football player. He drew a lot of attention. And there was another infielder from that Rhode Island area who became a fine ball player with the Dodgers for years. Infielder. I can't think of names or fans.
Okay. Did you have any mentor or anybody that helped you develop your scouting expertise? Did this come kind of by osmosis, so to speak?
No, I mean you have to. You're the guy that's going to suffer with it if it's bad. You might just as well go on what you see yourself. Always a lot of guys say, so-and-so over here is a pretty good ball player. You ought to get a look at him. You got about 30 of those on your list before the year starts. And with this New England weather, you're lucky if you see half of them.
Did you have particular friends that you relied on to give you good tips? Or?
Oh, no, just the old acquaintances you bump into, always talking baseball.
You used for reporting, did you have a special way that you recorded information? Did you have standard forms that they provided for the scouting reports? Or how
oh, that sure. They give you forms with all the information that you would possibly want.
And you have your stopwatch with you?
Yeah.
Did they have jug guns back in those days?
No.
No. And then how, did you have any customary way that you went about on a certain day? I mean, did you get to the game well before the game was going to start to talk to some of the players or see them in practice, or how did you work that?
Oh, that's number one, get there early. In my case particularly, I wasn't too familiar with that traffic around Boston and Hartford. I always was there an hour ahead, but you found that you're going to see more in the practice than you see in the game in most games. You may go see some guy and you won't see him make a hard throw for three or four games in the game. I mean, you may not get the chance. But you'll see it in the practice.
Do scouts try to find out the makeup of a person as far, a prospect, as far as their attitude is concerned, or their motivation? Do you try to do that or not?
If you should have an acquaintanceship with the coach, I mean, in fact, the coaches are usually more than willing to give you that information.
Did you have leeway in offering a signing bonus to a prospect? You'd always get a figure from the team and you couldn't vary from it?
If it's a high bonus, if it's a high bonus job, then you know that before you can get there. I mean, the fellow that's going to be demanding a high bonus is going to be seen by all your scouts and everybody else. You get there and you see scouts sitting everywhere.
So you would have a... If you were going to talk with that person, you'd have a figure, and if you felt you had to go higher, you'd have to get in touch with it.
No, you'd make out an excellent report on him, and then they'd send the cross-checker.
I see. So the cross-checker was the one who had the authority as far as money was concerned.
Well, he put in the final report, and then they, in the office, they measure those reports against the ones from the other scouts. If they have reports from five scouts on the same ball player, and undoubtedly those big high bonus jobs, everybody that owns a share of stock probably gets a look.
What do you feel made you a good scout?
I don't think I was.
Well, maybe others must have felt you were, because like you said, Mr. Rickey picked you to
well,
do some scouting there?
Anybody can tell if there's potential. That's obvious. But how the guy uses it and the depths and all, and some of the big bonus boys never did very much, you know.
Do you think there's a lot of personal instinct that a scout needs to have, or gut feeling?
Well, I think you ought to be a psychiatrist. You talk to boys and he thinks this is a glamorous game, glamorous life, easy money. Sure, he loves the game. When he goes down south, now he's playing with boys of equal or maybe better ability. He's maybe homesick. He's not doing so well. And the fans in the stands, they don't realize that this is a boy who isn't home. If he isn't doing well, they're just liable to get on him. You don't know how they're going to react. In other words, it depends on the boy. The intangibles.
Did you ever have any disagreements with the front office over a prospect you saw that really looked really good to you that they didn't follow up on?
Just tell them what you think, and that's it. You've done your job.
What, over the years, did you see changes in the prospect's ability or talent or dedication to the game or physical makeup as you went along in scouting over the years?
Well, as you know, every generation has been bigger than the previous one. And naturally, the big boys are more desirable. If they can do the other things, the power, the game of power game. There were a lot of small ball players when I was first in the league, quite a few. There were 3-4 small catches. In fact, Ray Schultz in the Hall of Fame. And quite a few small catches.
Al Lopez wasn't too big, was he? Hmm? Al Lopez wasn't too big either, was he?
No, he wasn't a big fellow. I'd say probably 170, 75.
What would you say are the plus and minuses of a scout's life?
What's that?
What would you say are the plus and minuses of a scout's life?
Being in the right place, I guess, at the right time.
That's a plus. What's a minus?
Oh, that's up to the individual. I mean, they all seem to have leanings in different directions, but the fundamental things is what you're looking for, and yeah, the rest of it has to be turned over to a psychiatrist. They make those decisions in the office.
Did you mind, as time went along, did you mind the travel and being away during the season?
You know, if you're not home, you want to be busy. Oh, I enjoyed every day of it.
What advice would you give for a new young scout today?
He doesn't. Everybody knows what they're looking for, and I mean, it's quite obvious. If you like the game,
was it customary for scouts to pass information amongst each other and talk about prospects and their what they saw, or were scouts pretty much closed mouth when it came to that?
Before the Major League Bureau was a very tight secret. You're just scouting for your own club.
Well, here's a question, Clyde. As I told you, one of the hopes that a lot of people have is that eventually scouts will be recognized in the Hall of Fame, in Cooperstown Baseball Hall of Fame. And if you were on the selection committee for the Hall of Fame to nominate a scout or one or more scouts to go into the Hall of Fame, who would you nominate?
Oh, well, number one, I will never be on that committee. I told you, one that had the most success that I can think of right offhand is Bill Enos.
Bill Enos with the Red Sox. Has he been with the Red Sox his whole career?
Oh, well, he's been at it a long time.
With the Red Sox, always with the Red Sox?
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, he's with the Browns as a player, and then I don't know if he's scouted for the Browns or not.
Uh-huh. And you consider him because of his success in signing so many players that turned out to be major leaguers, is that correct?
Well, that's the bottom line.
Uh-huh. And who would you rate as the best scout that you ever saw? Would you consider Bill Enos to be that person, or do you think somebody else?
I'm in no position to compare scouts or compare even great ball players. I mean, you're getting in the top field. Who's the greatest pitcher you ever saw? Now, they ask you questions like that. You get up around in that category, it's just one man's guess against another. I mean, the statistics over the years will tell you who the most successful one was.
And what professional baseball person would you say was the best judge of talent who was not a scout? Who would you put in that category?
Well, Branch Rickey wasn't listed as a scout with them.
No, this would be a not a scout person, but somebody that...
That would be Rickey. No question.
you were associated with him for many years, weren't you? So you really knew him well. Just kind of briefly, would you tell us about his personality and his, your workings with him? What kind of a person he came through as to you?
Well, that's a tough question. I do think he's a sort of a man that would have been an outstanding success in any line of endeavor. I mean, he was analyst and very observing and a real deep thinker. He was amazing. This isn't on the book, on the thing now, is it?
It's taping his.
Well, it's all right. I don't know of any better one.
Well, this is been nice visiting here with you, and you last week celebrated your 93rd birthday.
Congratulations. That again, please.
I say it's been nice visiting with you today, and last week you celebrated your 93rd birthday. Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
And what are you doing with your time daily now? How do you occupy your time besides reading the paper and so forth?
Oh, if you have a place in the country, you don't have to look for things to do. There's always something to do, particularly if you like the outdoors and things, hunting, fishing.
Did you go hunting this fall?
A little bit.
Do you have a consecutive streak of hunting?
I've hunted all my life. Everybody did. When I was a kid, it was a different world. Everybody was interested in baseball. Went back before World War I. It was a lot of people had big interest in baseball. We got our information. The Red Sox from being the closest club, why, they were the ones we were interested in mostly. They play today. There's no telephone. There's no radio. There's no TV. There's a newspaper that comes up by the stagecoach. The next afternoon, you find out what went on in yesterday's game. Transportation, that was confined pretty much to your 2 feet. We had a horse and a buggy, but we didn't get very far away.
Well, thank you very much, Clyde, and very best to you.
Well, thank you.